two up grappling hooks, raided the station, forced it off the air. Rogan and Tony Blackburn would follow me, Rogan on Radio 2, Blackburn on Radio 1. And the money had run out, and I found myself sleeping rough on the streets of Norwich.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Tom Edwards.
I can remember listening in to Listen With Mother, which I think was about 1:45 in the afternoon, with people like Daphne Oxenford, who I think used to either introduce the programme or read these stories, which fascinated me as a little boy growing up of maybe 4, 5, 6 years of age.
Good afternoon. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
So Listen With Mother, I certainly did, and Mum played an important part of my life in those days because, unfortunately, my dad died when I was only 5.
Tony and Anne were twins. They were 5 years old. It was nearly Christmas time, and their mother had promised to make new dressing gowns.
I can remember the huge radio that we had in Norwich on the outskirts of that fine home city of mine, and also being allowed to listen into, and I think David Jacobs was the announcer on it, or played a part in it, called Journey into Space.
Journey into Space.
You all set, Mitch?
Yes, Jet.
Doc?
Ready.
Okay, Doc. Booster? Jettison switch, stand by.
And children's are, of course. They were fabulous serials. And the marvellous thing about the wireless is if you hear a good drama on Radio 4 or as a small boy growing up, with radio you can conjure up pictures of the storyline that you're actually following. So my first love has got to be radio for more reasons than one.
When Toad found himself shut in a dank and noisome dungeon, and knew that all the grim darkness of a medieval...
After I left school, which I hated, algebra has been of no use to me whatsoever in my later life. And my dad, when he died, was managing director of a family business in Norwich called Brown and Edwards, which was wholesale grocery. And Mum and I had an argument about me going into the family business. She always said your father would have wished you to have gone into the family business. We've still got major shares in the business. And I was very reluctant to do this. So I went to the family business, and it was obvious from day one that they did not want me there, and I didn't want to be there. So after my first day, I cycled back home to Mum and said, I don't think this is going to work out. Mum was most upset about that. But then I saw an advertisement in the Stage newspaper for a Pontins Blue Coat, a Pontins holiday camp in Pakefield, near Lowestoft in Suffolk, not far from Norwich. And I went to see the entertainment manager, a lovely man who taught me so much about dealing with the public. And I had this interview with him, and he hired me on the spot. And I have to make some kind of acknowledgement to David Lever and to Pontins Holiday Camps, because in a way they got me into radio. It taught me the craft of meeting people, and it was tough work to have a smile on your face from 8 o'clock in the morning till sometimes gone midnight doing different shows. Pontins had this tannoy system, and in those days, and I think they've still got them on their shanties, little tannoy speakers where music is played, announcements are made. And it was 1964. I was a young man of 19. And all of a sudden, I was aware of this radio station that nobody at first could identify with, which was playing non-stop music nearly all day, and these disc jockeys ad-libbing, and the country had never heard anything like it.
This is Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station. The time now is 1 o'clock, and we've just been through an hour of non-stop music for Round Lunchtime Part 1. No, naturally enough, Round Lunchtime Part 2 with Christopher Moore.
And the more I listened in to this station and my little chalet number 13 it was, I had a small single chalet, I was loving the sounds that I was hearing. Also the music, of course, it was the swinging 60s. And I sent a tape to all of the radio stations. After 6 months, there was Radio London, and there were radio stations, pirate radio stations, all the way around the coastline. And out of the blue, a man called Reg Calvert, who was an agent in Denmark Street, rang me up and said, I've heard your tape, Tom. I'd like you to come down to Whitstable and we'll try you out for a weekend on Radio City. What I wasn't prepared for was a rough journey from Whitstable on this tiny fishing smack, the Harvester 2, out to these enormous structures. They're 90 feet high. built by a man called Maunsell as anti-aircraft gun towers, built during the Second World War. I haven't seen those towers for about 50 years, but they still stand. So I was hoisted up onto Radio City. They lowered this pallet, which was made out of an old cheese crate, with a rope hanging in the middle. So Harvester 2 was bobbing up and down. I had to time my jump onto this pallet and then be hoisted 90 feet up and then pulled in onto what was the arrivals platform. And I'm 90 feet having done this. But as a young man of 20 when I went to Radio City, the world was my oyster, I think. But looking back on those days, there were no health and safety regulations. We were against the law, but it was a fun time. I loved every moment of it. But when I see footage of myself being hoisted onto those towers, I'm absolutely terrified for myself and however I did it. And also, we had a man-made catwalk from one tower to the other. One tower was used for the transmitter and the studio. Then I would walk along this very shaky tightrope across the to another tower, thinking nobody else was around after I closed down Radio City for the night, but unaware, of course, that my mates were going to shake it at either end and laughing away. And I screamed my head off in terror.
Well, when that song was composed, they must have known that it could not possibly miss, and they were quite right. It's just one of those songs that just had to get right up in the hit parade.
We had no cartridge machines. What we did have was reel-to-reel stuff. In fact, I can remember that you had to make sure that commercials went out on time on a little reel-to-reel machine. And Reg, my boss, of course, also owned the Fortunes, who are very famous for You've Got Your Troubles and Here It Comes Again. And we used You've Got Your Troubles as a distress signal in case we were in trouble.
I see that worried look upon your face.
One disc jockey, unfortunately, played it by mistake, and Harvester 2 came out for no good reason. But yeah, it was rough out there. The conditions were basic, and it's awful having to bath in sea water. I mean, we had to have fresh water sent out to us, but if we wanted a shower, I think we did about 10 days on and maybe a few days off, and I made my home in Whitstable in the 2 years I was at Radio City. But being on the radio and playing the kind of music that we did was an absolute buzz, and judging by the amount of mail we got, we must have been doing something right.
You get a positive charge here on your Tower of Power.
So to the old town, the Motown fans for you now, it comes from the Four Tops, loving you is sweeter than ever.
Radio City was never a big station like Radio London or Radio Caroline. When I took over as radio DJ, I immediately decided that we had to do something to give the station more clout. And I've always been a stickler for time, so I insisted on having a proper studio clock that ran on batteries, of course. So our timing was to the second. I've always been a man for time. And also I thought it would give the station a better image and clout to have news bulletins. I would sit in my little office on the station and listening to Radio 4 News, it would be the old home service in those days, the Light Programme, the World Service, and maybe some American Forces networks that I could pick up. And I would jiggle these stories around and always listening to the BBC's running order. Sometimes I would change my running order. So we started doing news and weather bulletins, which I thought was good. But of course, I was lifting stories from other stations, as the other pirates did. Also, I didn't really have a playlist. There was never any sign of payola on Radio City, ever. But obviously, if Ridge had a record out, we had to play it. So we had really an open-ended playlist. I never sort of dictated to guys what we should play, but to try and keep it to the top 20 with one or two golden oldies thrown in. And we were sent dozens of records every single week by the record companies. I was sent an acetate copy of a song called Strangers in the Night by Frank Sinatra.
Strangers in the night.
And I said to my disc jockey colleagues on board, we need to play this a lot because it's going to be number one. And everybody poo-pooed that idea. For once in my life, I was right. But I love all kinds of music. We also had Monday to Friday, just a 30-minute program called The 5x4 Show, which was Beatles and Stones. John, George, Paul and Ringo, they were the four, and of course the five Rolling Stones. That produced hundreds and hundreds of postcards just for requests for this little half-hour show.
And just like to remind, of course, all you Beatley and Sony fans, you out there in Radio City listening, I'd like to remind you, I hope you'll be able to join me, Tom Odom, right about 5 o'clock this afternoon for the Saturday night edition of the 5x4 Show, commercial radio's most listened-to programme.
Financially, we were backed by American religious programmes with a man who sometimes used to nearly trip the transmitter off the air because he used to shout and scream, which was the A.A. Allen Revival Hour and the Voice of Prophecy.
In the name of Jesus, I command the blind eyes see. Cursed be this blindness. In the name of Jesus.
Those were our two main forms of revenue. We were getting audiences between us, all the different ships and towers around the country. Everybody was listening in to pirate radio. Nobody was listening into the BBC at all. All the BBC played in those days was perhaps the top 20. And Radio Luxembourg, if you could pick up the signal, that always faded in and out. Pirate radio, started up by Ronan O'Reilly, I think really changed everything as far as the wireless is concerned. The BBC certainly had to rethink their strategy.
Good morning, everyone. This is the BBC night programme on wavelengths of 1,500 and 261 metres. Now I'm handing over the microphone to a colleague who will bring you the news.
I think Reg more or less regarded me. He told me once that he always wanted a son. I think he put me under his protective wing, so to speak. I liked him when I first met him. I became very friendly with him. I also got very friendly with his wife, Dorothy Calvert, and their two daughters, Susan and Candy. And Reg was a businessman, got very excited, sometimes lost his temper, and at one point fired everybody on the station because he'd heard that they were trying to form a company to run Radio City, which he didn't like, and he fired everybody on the spot, never saw them again. And made me there and then on the spot saying, you are the chief disc jockey, Tom. Yes, I liked Reg Calvert. He used to race out all the latest releases to us. He also had a group called Pinkerton's Assorted Colours. If they had a record out, we had to play it because it was his station, so why not?
Mirror, mirror, on the wall. Mirror, mirror, on the wall.
So I have happy memories of Reg. I knew that there was some kind of deal going on with Radio London to look at Radio City, and it was decided that the station would be called not Radio City anymore, but UKGM, United Kingdom Good Music, a bit like Radio 390, which was sitting next to us further down another set of towers, the Red Sands Towers.
You're listening to Russ Conway at the Piano, presented by Radio 390, your family station.
And I would remain on UKGM.
Wonderful Big L.
But there was a man called Major Oliver Smedley who was involved with Radio Caroline who heard about this merger deal. And he reckoned that he'd installed a transmitter on Radio City, which, between you and I, simply didn't work, and was asking Reg Calvert for £10,000 for this transmitter. And Reg more or less told him in a nice way to go away, much to his cost, because Smedley was not happy about not getting his money, not happy about the takeover bid. Smedley got a barge full of gangsters, very heavy-duty guys, who threw up grappling hooks onto Radio City, armed with guns and knives, took the crystal out of the transmitter, and Radio City was off the air, which led to one of the biggest stories ever of the summer of 1966, a very gruesome time.
Major Oliver Smedley, a former vice president of the Liberal Party executive, was remanded at Saffron Walden in Essex, charged with the murder of Mr. Reg Calvert, head of the pirate radio station Radio City.
There wasn't the communication we have now. There were no mobile phones in those days. So when I woke up one morning at Whitstable, there was no signal from Radio City. And I couldn't make out why. And the station, we're always having technical problems. It was unusual to be off the air for so long. And eventually I got the word that Reg Calvert, on the first charge, had been shot dead by a 12-bore shotgun at a place called Wembo's End near Saffron Walden in Essex. He was furious that Major Smedley had sent out this barge full of guys armed with knives and guns. They threw up grappling hooks, raided the station, forced it off the air, and more or less was holding the station and its inhabitants at the time to ransom. Unless Smedley got his money, the station would stay off the air. And I saw Reg shortly before he went to see Smedley. He was a very angry man. Radio City was his baby. Again, I've got to say, it was never a big station as the other stations maybe were, like Radio Caroline, Radio London. But we had a loyal audience. So unbeknown to me, he drove up with a driver to Smedley's cottage to have it out with him. And a terrible argument ensued. And Smedley, fearing for his safety and also for his mistress's safety, because she'd been knocked to the ground, he picked up a 12-bore shotgun and shot Reg Calvert. Obviously, he was arrested. This news shattered me because I'd been with Reg maybe only a few hours before. And I went back to Whitstable. And I can remember the following morning is not only my home, but the whole of Whitstable was surrounded by the press. And there were helicopters and pressmen hiring anything that floated, from a dinghy to a small fishing smack, to get out to the towers, because this turned out to be perhaps the biggest story about radio of the decade in July of 1966. And I did perhaps one of the bravest things I've ever done in my life. And looking back on it, I must have been mad. I went with a member of Essex Police, a man called Detective Superintendent Gordon Brown, and other police officers, going out to Radio City, knowing that these raiders were still out there. It's the bravest thing I've ever done in my life, apart from not hitting the bottle anymore. We were all hoisted 90 feet above sea level, surrounded by this flotilla of ships and aircraft flying around the towers. I've never forgotten that day. And meeting Michael Nicholson, who's reporting for ITN. I mean, it's their lead story. And the leader of the gang, a man called Big Alf Bullen, knew who I was, came straight up to me with his hand outstretched to shake it and said, "We're sorry, Tom, we didn't expect anybody. We didn't want anybody to get killed." And I stayed on Radio City, didn't go back to shore with the police, made sure that my staff were okay. But wherever we went on the towers after the police had left, made a few inquiries, the press were still having a look at us. But wherever we went from one tower to the other, we were followed by these men who were armed. Even when we tried to get some sleep, they would shine a torch in our faces. It was such a shock. And my main concern, I think, really, was for Dorothy Calvert and the two daughters, who I knew very well. And, of course, my mother was also terrified hearing about all this, not only on the radio, but also on Anglia television, because I was a local Norwich man, so Anglia ran a big story on all of this. I was so shocked about the scenario of Reg, I thought this is the end of Radio City. But immediately, within a matter of hours of Reg being so dramatically killed, his wife, Dorothy, a strong lady, said, "I will continue to run the station as long as I possibly can." And she was true to her word. She did. Eventually, it was a long court case. Smedley was originally charged with murder, manslaughter, self-defense, and the case was really thrown out of court, and he walked out of court a free man.
And the extraordinary and tragic events of the last 24 hours suggest that it is high time that something was done.
Now, these events went around a fault in the Thames estuary. Some people have suggested, in fact, without any additional legislation.
I knew after the death of Reg, and Dorothy carried on with the station. But the government at the time was run by a man called Harold Wilson, and a man called Anthony Wedgwood Benn was so much against pirate radio. They said that we interfere with ship-to-shore distress signals. Whether that was true in the final analysis, I don't know. But those two people's names stick out in my mind, Harold Wilson and Anthony Wedgwood Benn.
They're stealing the copyright and paying no money for it. They're playing records that musicians have recorded and giving them no money for it. They're endangering the ship-to-shore radio, and there's a real
risk. The shooting of Reg Calvert and this enormous, huge story gave the government the impetus to fast forward the Marine Offences Bill, which would come into force in August of 1967. In February of 1967, Dorothy Calvert was taken to court in Essex for broadcasting within territorial waters. We always maintained that the Radio City Towers at Shivering Sands were outside territorial waters. And again, I think maybe some lines were altered in the territory, but they decided we were just within territorial waters. And Dorothy fought this case very hard, but eventually was found guilty of illegal broadcasting and was fined £100, which is, or was, a lot of money in those days, £100. Again, no mobile phones. So Freddie Downes came out on his boat with an envelope, which I've still got somewhere, with a letter inside it addressed to me personally. I said, "I'm so sorry, Tom, but the station has to close down tonight for good." And my immediate thought was, what am I going to say? What are we going to do? So I told everybody what was happening, and I think by that time it was in the public domain on the television news. I thought, how do I do a final hour of a radio station that I've loved and worked for and been, I hope, an important part of, Radio City, on 299 metres? What on earth do I do? I can't play sad music and say, woe is us, etc., because that would be not very nice, a bit too twee. So I thought, right, I'll get everybody in the studio for the last hour. And that was the engineers, the disc jockeys, and even our chef, all into the studio. And that last hour just took off. I don't think we really played any music at all, because we talked quite openly about the shooting of Reg Calvert and also about the government being so darn set against pirate radio. It really did break my heart. And I always remember the last record I played was Shirley Bassey singing The Party's Over, followed, I might add, by the national anthem, which I insisted when I took charge of Radio City, I'm a great royalist. And I insisted that everybody, if I wasn't on duty, the national anthem should be played every night, and it was.
The party's over.
So we chatted for this hour, all my fellow disc jockeys, some of whom are still with me. Ian McRae is alive and well. Adrian Love was the disc jockey there. Ian Dunn was the chef. Phil Perkins was one of the engineers. Paul Kramer was on board. Paul got killed some weeks later. So I remember that last hour very well indeed, and I'm still reminded of it. So, a sad day.
It's 4 minutes before 12 midnight, ladies and gentlemen. I haven't rehearsed this, I don't know what to say, but for all the lads out here on Radio City, for us, at the present time anyway, the party really is over.
I just went with the flow. I didn't have a script or anything. And I think I said something on the lines of, well, that's really the end of it. We've all had our say. I can't quote myself word for word because half a century ago, David, come on. And played that immediately with me saying, that's all from us, from Radio City, good night and goodbye. And then the national anthem. And I've heard tapes of that last programme, David. And you suddenly hear the signal just go as they switch the transmitter off. And I had a few tears in my eyes that day.
For me, Tom, it was for the very last time on Radio City. It's a very good night to you, ladies and gentlemen. God bless, and thank you for being a marvellous audience. Good night, and goodbye.
Dorothy Cull promised us all that she will try and find us work. And remember, I was renting a beach house on Whitstable seafront. Dorothy was true to her word, and within a matter of, I think, maybe a few days, maybe a couple of weeks, again, I'm going back over half a century, I was on board the most famous ship of all, the Mi Amigo, also known as Radio Caroline. I had to leave my home in Whitstable, but I went back to live with my mum because it was easy peasy for me to go from Norwich to Ipswich, where we had a bus or a coach to meet us, to take us down to Felixstowe Docks in Essex, and then out to the ship. And I remember my first visit to Radio Caroline, I was on board Offshore One with Johnny Walker and Robbie Dale. And we hit the most terrible weather. And I seem to remember either Robbie or JW was smoking a cigar and I turned green. And Robbie Dale looked at me and said, "You don't look too good, Tom." I said, "No, I'll be okay." And of course, what I wasn't prepared for on the towers, which used to shake or sway in very heavy weather, a bit like an aircraft's wing will slowly move up and down, which proves to us all it's safe. and I had to jump from the tender onto the ship. You had to time it a bit like getting onto Radio City, with the tender bashing up against the side of the ship. You had to gauge that jump, because if you didn't, you'd be crushed between the two ships. It was a big tugboat that took us out, offshore one. And I got on board Radio Caroline. I was viewed with a lot of suspicion at first. What I did find out, like on Radio City, you cannot afford to have an ego if you're on a radio station, any radio station that's either on terra firma or out in the bloody North Sea, because you will soon be thrown overboard, as many people in the business have found. I worked with Robbie and Johnny, a man who I thought was terrific TV on radio, Tommy Vance, unfortunately no longer with us.
Matthew and Son, a fabulous arrangement by Jeff Hurst, a Cat Stevens number, sung by Cat himself on the D-Ram label, and it's number two these days on the Radio Caroline Countdown of Sound. It's 8 minutes in front of 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mike Ahern, who was so popular with the housewives. Keith Hampshire was out on Radio Caroline, still in touch with him in Canada. Steve Young, and also my old mucker, Ian McRae, who I first met on Radio City. I had to get used to the rock and roll of the ship. We were on a swivel anchor, which meant the boat didn't rock and roll, but it used to dip because you had the transmitter in the bows. So the Mi Amigo used to dip quite a lot. And my mother, after a few months of being on Radio Caroline, I don't know whether she thought I was drunk or inebriated, but when you've been on the ship for 2 weeks, I had some kind of wobbly walk, which stays with you for a couple of days, because you actually walk with the movement of the boat while you're on board. And my mother said, you're walking a strange way, Tom. How much have you had to drink? No, I said, it's the ship, Mum. I'm just on shore leave. And that summer of 67 was wonderful because hundreds of people would come out every day. And the people at Felixstowe and Walton-on-the-Naze and other ports down off the East Coast, all these fishermen were making a fortune because they're bringing all our listeners out to meet us. In the middle of the 1960s, looking back, the most fabulous musical time. Beautiful era. All manner of music, both pop, rock and roll, soul, Tamla Motown, wonderful stuff. I used to sunbathe. It was a gorgeous summer of 67. I used to sunbathe by the transmitting mast until the Dutch captain said to me, really shouldn't do that because it's going to turn you bald or sterile. I went, oh yes, and I remember Dave Lee Travers and I got a fluorescent tube and held it up against the mast and the thing lit up because of all the RF coming off the transmitting mast. I'm accused of living in the past maybe too much, talking like I am to you at the moment, but I think from the past you can learn for the future. And it's no harm looking back on such a great 3 years out in the North Sea. I found out that I had to stick to something called a playlist. And that playlist really was the majority of major minor labels, with the Dubliners. And I love the Irish, but playing the Dubliners all the time was not my style. And David McWilliams, I believe, we had to play his record quite a lot because the records were being paid for by a man called Phil Solomon, who had a big chunk of Radio Caroline.
A tenement, a dirty street, walked and worn by shoeless feet, in silence long and so complete, watched by a shivering sun.
And I can remember Johnny Walker getting so brassed off of this that one night he suddenly threw them all into the ocean. And I didn't like the thought of playing records that I personally didn't like and they were being paid for. But I kept a good face on it and a good voice.
But in June of last year, when we had all the tragic events on Radio City, the police told me that they could do nothing about the men out here for the simple reason we were outside the police's jurisdiction. Now, how is it that 6 or 7 months later, the GPO now summons us and get away with it?
We saw storm clouds gathering because in August of that year, August the 14th, was the day that the Marine Offences Bill would actually be passed. And if I was caught after that date working for Radio Caroline and I was stopped by the authorities, it seems so ridiculous today, David, I would have gone to prison or been fined. Andy Archer, lovely friend of mine who lives just across the border from me in Norfolk, my home county, I think he was the only disc jockey that was fined £100. And also an easy feel because we didn't know what the future held. But the writing was on the wall. The Marine Offences Bill, was on August the 14th, which was a Monday that day. It was changeover time. Johnny Walker and Robbie Dale were coming out full of it all because they were going to defy the government and stay on board. I was due to go on a shore leave. And Johnny Walker looked me straight in the eye, and he's never forgiven me for this. And he said, you are coming back, aren't you, Tom? And as soon as I said yes, looking him straight in the eye, as I am at you now, David, I knew I was lying, because I thought there's really no future in going back to Radio Caroline.
And as we enter this new phase in our broadcasting history, you naturally have our assurance that we intend to stay on the air because we belong to you and we love you.
The guys who opted to stay on board would have to travel to the Netherlands, and it would be an 11-hour journey from the Netherlands back to the mooring of Walton-on-the-Naze. A journey which I've since been told was absolutely horrendous. They were running short of money, they were running out of food, at times they were running out of water. And again, I went home to Mum in Norwich with no prospects at all. And out of the blue, I just knocked on the door of BBC East at this beautiful building. I don't know if you ever saw it at All Saints Green, the most gorgeous Georgian house in a lovely setting. And they put out local programmes on Radio 4 VHF and also did Look East. I went to meet the boss man. In a matter of weeks, at the age of 22, I was introducing Look East and doing a Radio 4 opt-out on a Saturday morning called Happy Weekend, Everybody. Radio 4 opt-outs, if you were rich enough, you had a VHF radio, and not many people had these radios. Radio 4 would carry on the medium wave, but VHF, of course, was for very rich people who could afford a VHF set. I met the producer, a lovely man called Tom Wisdom, who was a real BBC producer, who smoked like a chimney, was always betting on horses, and drank like a fish. He was sometimes very difficult to work with and work for sometimes. And I did this magazine-type program, asking for requests and playing records, which had to be cued on the grams by a hand signal from me. I wasn't self-operating like we did on Pirate Radio. And there was uproar in the Eastern Daily Press and letters being sent to the BBC of complaints saying, why is this pirate disc jockey now on my Radio 4 VHF expensive set playing pop music? And I love doing Look East. I mean, I learnt my craft of doing live television. Everything was live in those days, unless it was shot on the film, no videotape then. But as much as I love the pirates, I love the BBC. My mother was so proud of her son, because here I was with a corporation and I was on terra firma. And eventually things would rapidly change within a matter of a few months. I'd forgotten I'd sent a tape of my Radio Caroline show to Radio 1, which has had to be started after the pirates had gone. You lost the light programme, the home service, the third programme, and you got Radios 1, 2, 3 and 4. And I'd forgotten I'd sent a boss man at Radios 1 and 2 a tape, and he rang me up one day at Mum's in Norwich saying, we've heard the tape, Tom, we'd like you to take over from Simon D, one of the first disc jockeys on Radio Caroline. We want you to replace him on Simon D's midday spin on January the 1st, 1968, which I did.
It's on 12 noon, ladies and gentlemen, and it's Monday and time for Midday Spin. My name is Tom Edwards. Good afternoon. As Mr. Jimmy Young has just mentioned, it is very windy, especially in London, right at the top here of Broadcasting House. Very, very drafty. Anyway,
my hand shook when I tried to queue up the first record on that show, because I knew that everybody would be listening in on Radios 1 and 2. I replaced Simon D, who then was on a fantastic career, which unfortunately nosedived because the ego got in the way. A great loss. And I started to commute between Norwich and London doing Look East and doing Radio 1 shows, which got too much. But then a man called Douglas Muggeridge, who was the controller of programmes for 1 and 2, Malcolm Muggeridge's brother, and Jimmy Kingsbury, who was to become my boss, said, we'd like you on the staff of the BBC, and I jumped at the chance, so I moved to the big city.
Oh yes, marvellous stuff there from Mr. Junior Walker and the All-Stars, and another call, Come See About Me. So there I was, sort of round about half an hour ago, sort of busily rehearsing, you see. We do have a rehearsal here at the BBC, believe it or not, and a charming young lady...
I think the BBC were trying to learn from us, because they built studios that we were used to self-op the whole system. And I believe that the producers that I was given, it was something that I couldn't believe in my early days at Radio 1 and 2. I would sit as I am opposite you, David, but you'd be sitting with a stopwatch in your hand. And I wasn't used to that. And sometimes having to follow something called a script. I fortunately got on well with most of the producers, but I didn't like their presence in the studio. I felt inhibited. That eventually changed.
7:30 is the time, and this is Tom Edwards.
The band in your pocket...
It was great fun. I mean, I ended up doing extraordinary programs. I loved doing the Radio 1 Club when I was a freelance going around the country. But on the staff, I did amazing programs. So I remember doing a New Year's Eve program from the Dorchester Hotel with Joe Loss's orchestra, with Ray Moore, who was up in Scotland for Hogmanay as well. And I loved Ray Moore. Ray Moore, remembered by so many people, one of the best broadcasters ever. He took me through my first overnight shift of announcing and news reading. You started that shift at 4:30 in the afternoon, right through until the shipping forecast at 00:33, then across to the Langham, if you were lucky, for 2 or 3 hours sleep, then up again at 5 to do half-hourly bulletins on Radios 1 and 2 until 10:30 in the morning. I detested that shift. But Ray took me through that first overnight shift, and he was so kind and friendly, and I picked up a lot not only from fellow presenters, but also from producers. And I had a happy time at the BBC. I worked for a man who was manic about two things, and two things only, the shipping forecast and pronunciation. I still have my BBC pronunciation dictionary in the cabinet over there. And Kingsbury was manic about pronunciation. But these people would hand me my news bulletins, especially the midnight one, which I dreaded, just page by page, by changing it. And usually the news editor stinking of scotch standing behind me, really not knowing what time of day it was. But I loved the buzz of live radio. And then I started to do the early show, which meant getting up at 3:30 in the morning to open up the networks at 5 a.m., plus news reading, then doing a 2 or 2.5 hour show.
And a very good morning to you, wherever you're listening, this Saturday morning, Saturday the 5th of November. Radio 2 coming your way on VHF, 247 and 1500 metres long wave, not forgetting those of you in tune with your BBC local radio stations.
It was on Radios 1 and 2, this early show, and I had to adjust the whole of my personal life. And maybe this is where my drinking problem first started to take control of me. I thought, if I have 2 or 3 good shots of a whiskey or a gin, it'll get me to sleep at the Langham and I'll be up at 3:30. But looking back on that time, I was aware of a drinking culture at the BBC. The first time I went to the BBC club after my first, did my first show, the controller and Derek Chinnery's, will take you across to the BBC club, Tom. And I saw all these people from either Mrs. Dale's Diary or Wagoner's Walk, and newsreaders, I won't name names, and well-known newsreaders, who were absolutely hammered at lunchtime. And I looked at them with a certain amount of disdain. I thought, all these people are drunk. How do they keep a job down? So I was aware of the drinking culture right from my working at the BBC in London. And I did the early show, which to begin with was a joy to do. I saw the footage of Ray Moore only last night of being interviewed on the Wogan show, because Wogan and Tony Blackburn would follow me, Wogan on Radio 2, bless him, and Blackburn on Radio 1. And I looked at Ray, like he looked, I don't mean this disrespectfully, but he looked burned out on the Terry Wogan show, because getting up every morning at 3:30 is a killer. It alters your whole lifestyle. Some people can do it, like falling off a log. I'm not that person. I hated getting up so early. So in 1979... big jump for me, I decided to leave the staff of the BBC and I went freelance. I'd already been to see the bosses at Thames Television, who wanted me to do a one-day tryout as an InVision announcer. In those days, you could see the announcer InVision. And Thames said, yes, we'd love to use you, Tom, after my first day. It was the worst year for me to have gone freelance because I was up in Newcastle at the time at Tyne Tees Television. And ITV went on strike in 1979. Not for 1 or 2 days, not for 2 or 3 weeks, but for 3 months, 11 weeks. But what a time for me to choose to go freelance in 3 months. Hardly any work coming in. I ended up working for Thames Television, one of the best companies I've ever worked for. And I did that 5 days a week usually, and then at the weekends I was working 7 days a week, flying down to Harlech Television in Cardiff and later at Bristol to do newsreading and presentation down there. So I was working 7 days a week, travelling through the night sometimes to get back at Thames for a Monday. And the harder I worked, the harder I drank. And for the next 10 years, I had a lovely home and a partner, lived in St. John's Wood, had a lovely lifestyle. And when you're a freelance, Pete Murray, bless him, once told me, when you're freelance, Tom, you have to accept everything that's given to you, because if you turn it down once, they will never come back to you a second time. I believe that to be true even today. So that was a valuable piece of advice from Pete Murray. And I was working 7 days a week. The harder I worked, the harder I drank, which was beginning to affect my personal life as well. But then I went out to America on one of three visits, and I met a man called Casey Kasem, very famous disc jockey in America. I met him.
Here we go with the top 40 hits in the nation this week on American Top 40, the best-selling and most played songs from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from Canada to Mexico.
Everybody thought my voice was cute and quaint. So I left Thames in the 80s and went to live in Los Angeles. LA is a tough town to be in, and my agent used to send me for all manner of voiceover jobs. And I remember one instance going into a studio, and there were about 30 other guys. My English voice, I thought, gave me a bit more of a clout for this commercial they wanted. And I just walked into the studio, said hello to the director, and said, "How are you?" And he looked me up and down and said, "Thank you, next." And I was out of the door. It's as rough as that. I mean, you're as good as your last performance. It's a very, very tough town, Los Angeles. And in 1990, I suddenly woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was 1 o'clock lunchtime over here. So I rang Mum in Norwich and I said, "I think your baby is coming home." I was just very homesick, not only for Norfolk, but to see my mother. So I flew back to Norfolk. Bit of a culture shock having lived in LA and suddenly back in Norwich, as much as I love the city. But I adjusted to being back in Norfolk. I was pleased to see my mother, who by that time was quite an elderly lady. We had a heart-to-heart talk and said, "What are you going to do, Tom?" And I said, "I really don't know." But out of curiosity, I tapped on the door of BBC East. And Ted Gorton was the boss man there then, welcomed me with open arms. And lo and behold, I was going back to doing Look East, the dreaded breakfast newsers on television, the opt-out out of breakfast time. And also something new had happened in Norwich, which is called Radio Norfolk.
This is the first glimpse of their new radio station that the public will have. It's the reception area, the place where you can bring your dedications, your record requests.
And I ended up doing Look East, at first a nightly programme locally on Radio Norfolk, but that started to clash with Look East. So I ended up doing Sunday nights for them and worked for a lovely man who's become a very good friend today, still is, David Clayton. But unfortunately, my drinking had taken control of me, I suppose, 100% in a way. Also, looking back at that time, my mother had also turned alcoholic. So this was a very difficult situation for me to be in. And I carried on for 2 years at the BBC. It's very tough for me to talk about this. And I had a message from the editor of Look East. And I was newsreading earlier that morning. He said, "I'm in the Cambridge studio, Tom. I need to have a word with you." I went, "Okay." And it got to midday, and I just had the long lunchtime read to do at 10 to 1. I thought, I'll go and see him an hour early because I really need to go home. I'm tired. And it was obvious to me that he had a couple of drinks. He said, "I wanted to see you after you'd finished, Tom." I said, "I'm actually very tired, and I need to get home to get some rest." So he said, "Right, take a seat. This won't affect you at first." And I thought, here we go again. I've heard this scenario so many times. He said, "This won't affect you at first, but for Look East and especially the morning bulletins, I want a new name, a new image, a new face, etc., etc." And I knew that he had a certain young lady that he knew waiting in the wings, and asked me something which even today I suppose I still find quite insulting. He said, "Well, won't it affect you at first, but eventually it will, and I want this lady to follow you so you can train her how to do the job," which involved a self-op desk in vision on television. It was very complicated. You'd be hearing two sets of talkback, one from Norwich and one from London. Very difficult opt-out to do. And I refused. And words were exchanged. I undid my tie, wiped off my bit of TV slap, and said, "I'm history. I refuse to accept this." And he asked me, "What about the lunchtime bulletin?" And I told him in no uncertain terms what to do with it. My mother, when I got home, was more upset about this, perhaps, than I was. And that night, the local newspapers came to the front door and said to my Mrs. Edwards, "We're looking for Tom. Can we have a word? Because we've heard what's happened." I had two lady colleagues of mine, again, I won't mention them, from Anglia Television, ring me up immediately saying, "This is awful, Tom. This shouldn't have happened." But the press arrived at Mum's front door, the local newspaper people, and said, "Where is your son?" She said, "He's up at the pub." And I gave a statement to the press, which appeared on the front page the following morning. It was a tough time. Mum was very upset about it all, far more than I was. But worse was yet to happen. About 2 months after these events, my mother and I had had something of an argument. And the following morning, I did something I did never did for my mother, was to make her a cup of tea. I was making a cup of tea. I said, "You and I argued last night, Mum. I'm your son. We really shouldn't argue like this. I'm going to take you down to the pub for a pub lunch." She said, "I would love that." So I said, "Well, go and put your coat on." So I'm making Mum a cup of tea. And I heard a noise, which perhaps I hope I never hear again, which is a loud snoring noise. And I went upstairs, called up to my mother, and I even brought up the mug of tea to her bedside, and my mother was there, and I was aware that something was very, very wrong. And of course my mother had died, and I'd never seen death that close before. So those were two major events. I've lost two things in my life. The mum who brought me up when Dad died when I was five. She'd gone, this terrible disaster at the BBC. And the only way I knew how to solve that was to pick up my friend, which was a bottle of scotch. And it took me 3 years to slide down the razor blade of life. And the money had run out. And I found myself sleeping rough on the streets of Norwich. I always thought that kind of thing happened to other people. It wouldn't happen to me, but it did. And I was in the most terrible state. But, again, I believe in fate, somebody must have been looking over me. Des Cox, who used to be the old film editor on Look East, who I used to watch splice up the film after I'd done the report, remembered me so well, and he and two lady friends searched the streets of Norwich until they found me. And Des took me home to the safety of his house. I had to put me in his caravan in the back garden because I could hardly walk. I was in a very bad way. And Des tried all manner of ways to help me. My GP didn't want to know, other people didn't know. But then through Norfolk Social Services, bless them, they said, "We've got a place which, you know, Tom should go to called Ferdows Clinic." And it's a clinic in Heckington. And I thought, where the hell is Heckington? And I arrived some weeks later, not in a very good state, crossed the threshold and met Dr. Morsi, who ran the clinic, who said, after he'd done a medical examination, said, "If you carry on like this, Tom, you won't be here in 2 weeks." And being in quite a facetious mood, because I didn't want to be there, I said, I'll be discharged then. He said, "No, you'll be dead." And then my well-being, in a way, was taken away from me, because I then went into detox. What I can remember of it, proud is not probably the right word, but normally a detox these days takes 4 to 5 days. Mine took 6 weeks. I was very ill. And I was to end in the clinic for about nearly 3 years. I mean, I had no money. I arrived with the clothes that I stood up in. So I was in a very sad state. But about 5 months into my stay there, as I was getting a little bit better, somebody gave me a typewriter. I've always loved to write. And I had the idea for an article for the Sunday Times magazine, and I think they still run this page, which is called A Day in the Life Of. So I sent it off to the editor, Hilary Stafford Clark, and she immediately came back to me and said, I like this. I wrote this article. It appeared on the 1st of January, 1996. I remember going to the newsagents that Sunday morning at 7 a.m., buying a copy of the Sunday Times, and there was the article with a very sorry picture of me looking through the window of the clinic, looking quite unwell. What I wasn't prepared for, I started to get about 100 letters a day at the clinic from people from all over the world, from people I'd worked with. And I had letters, everyone which I read, most of them I replied to. But one day, I had an envelope with a Barbados stamp on it. Opened up this letter, didn't recognise the ink handwriting, and I fluttered this cheque, which was for £500. And it was from Bob Monkhouse and his wife Jackie. And he said, we've read your piece in the Sunday Times. I've still got that first letter. I've kept all his letters. Hell has happened to you. We remember you at the film premiere of That's Entertainment Part One, that marvellous film of all the MGM musicals. Bob Monkhouse was also a great film buff. And I remember meeting him and his wife Jackie at the reception of That's Entertainment in Leicester Square. And he remembered me from that one-off meeting. We're sorry if we're intruding. Will you please accept this as a gift from us? And if there's anything we can do to help you, within reason, we will. So I started up this extraordinary exchange by letters and countless phone calls to the Monkhouses. And it got to a stage where after nearly 3 years of being in the clinic, A, I was much stronger. Also, I was frightening of being institutionalized to being in a place like that. But then it got to be about 1998, and I'd been in the clinic for nearly 3 years, and the more I saw of this little village called Heckington, the more I liked it. And I decided that this had to be my home. I had nothing. I just arrived with the clothes I stood up in. And I thought, I need to get out of the clinic. So I did leave. I got myself a little bed sit in the village. And then I moved to a lovely old cottage in Eastgate, where I was for a few years. And that timing was right for me to leave the clinic, because Monkhouse got in touch with me and said, now you're out of the clinic, Tom, we need to get you working. I want you to do the voiceovers on Wipeout, which was a quiz show he was doing. It was awesome going back up to Granada Television and meeting Bob again properly for the first time after all those years. And I said to Bob, I think I'm going to cry. So he said, well, you go into your dressing room, I'll go into mine. So a very emotional moment for the two of us to be together. I got paid for that.
See, I feel absolutely great. I beat my wife at Scrabble last night. First time I've ever had her at a loss for words.
I think I'd also written something for the local paper back in Norwich to let people know I was alive and well. And David Clayton got in touch with me, and he was doing a morning show. And David eventually became editor of Radio Norfolk, the big boss. And he said, I'd like to do a live interview with you. And I said, well, let's do it the easy way. Let me go up to BBC Lincoln and we'll do it down the line. And we had this chat, and David wanted me to choose a record which always reduces me to tears, which is Diana Ross, When You Tell Me That You Love Me, which my mother loved, I loved. It was at the time when she died and I had the fallout with the BBC. So this record has a lot of emotion, feeling and memories going back quite a few years now. When you tell me that you love me. And I remember when David put this on to play, he spoke to me on the talkback and said, are you okay, Tom? I said, I'm fine, but I'm about to go here. He said, so am I, and so is Maggie, who's sitting in the studio with him in Norwich. And I must have impressed David that day, because he's asked me back so many times to Norwich. It's great to prove to myself and to other people that I can still do the job to the best of my ability. And also with the BBC, although David has resigned now from the BBC, I am so pleased that it was a badly burnt bridge, David, at the BBC at Norwich. That badly burnt bridge has been completely rebuilt. So I'm chuffed about that. And I like to think my mum would be pleased about that as well.
Joining us on the music game today is Joyce Miller, who is in Mansfield. Hiya, Joyce.
Hiya, David.
And I think it was through David Hamilton, who I've known for years, because David was doing a daily show out of Saga, a station that I loved. I was so upset when that station was no more. I loved that station. Paul Robey wouldn't answer my phone calls at first or something. And I think through my connection with David, I think Paul got in touch with me just to help out on the odd day. It's not what you know in life, but who you know. And I love going over to Saga. It was a great little station.
Saga 106.6 FM.
I can't believe I had my finger on that self-destruct button for so long. There have been two instances since I've been sober. When back in 2005, my voice had completely gone, and I went to see an ear, nose and throat man, Boston Hospital, and he looked down the throat and said, "It looks like cancer of the larynx, Tom." And to cut a long story short, I saw the whole of my life go in front of me, and I thought, you can cut everything off, but do not take my voice. I remember shaking my fist at the sky. He put me to sleep for a long time and said, "We're not gods. It's not as bad as I thought, but you need to keep a check on your smoking and your lifestyle." As I've gotten older, I've lost so many dear friends that I loved dearly. It's made me grow up. And having been homeless, with nothing in my pocket and no food in my stomach, has made me a better man than I was before. It's a wake-up call. I'm desperately sorry for the people that I upset, an ex-partner of mine who I really want to say I'm so sorry to. Take a look at me now, because I've got myself well and good again. I would like to think that I'm still quite a nice person. I love life. And the one thing that I want to do, having spoken to you today as I have, I did an evening with here locally, which was a packed house. I was thrilled about that. And all the proceeds went to the church. Is that now leads me up. And if anybody's listening into this, I really think it's high time that I got my book off the ground. I want to get that under my belt. It is written. It is written. I update it every quarter, every 3 months. But my last goal is I want to have that book, not as an ego trip, but in the hope it might be of interest for people who love pirate radio, who never heard of pirate radio. But I want to see that on the library van that comes into the village every week. When I go to meet my maker, whenever that is, I don't want all these stories to be lost. I yearn for peace, quiet, and contentment. I'm nearly there, I think. I've got the peace and the quiet.